TLS is go for main engine start.
Go at throttle up. Negative return. Then we see a nominal Miko. Welcome to space.
Hello. Welcome to main engine cutoff. No, I did it again, Jake.
No,
God.
No.
My issue is when I do the main. I did Miko this morning, and I can't get my brain out of that's the show. This is all phenomenal.
Can't you see that I have the little sticker up on the wall here with the off nominal logo?
I need some
logo?
Cue cards or something. You either need to do all the intros or I need
that?
Cue cards.
All right.
We got Caleb. Caleb Henry is in. He's in my town right now, but he is not in my house.
Hey, Caleb.
Unfortunately. How you doing, Caleb?
Hey. Yep. Up in Philly.
And
I like hesitate. I wanted to say like the city of brotherly love, but I feel like everybody does that. It's just like, no, it's Philly. It's the 215.
Go with
whatever.
The always sunny jokes. But, we are going to eat some dinner after this, which is going to be great. But Jake, I'll Skype you in or something.
All right. Sounds
call
good.
In.
I appreciate that. I appreciate being included. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. I'll send you some pics. Did you, Jake, you went to Costco earlier. Did you get any drinks at Costco?
Well, kind of. Not for this thing, but, you know, I spent a lot of money at Costco like you do, but all this stuff I had to go get ahead of time because I had to make sure I had it. But, okay, so there's a little bit of theater to this one today. So, so I started with, this is called a twisted bocktail. So this is, it's just tequila and orange liqueur, lemon juice, and I'm missing one. Shit. Something else is in here. We'll find out what it is. It's got a bunch of ingredients. Simple syrup. That's what it is. But the trick of this one that's supposed to make it special is that you top it up with a beer, with a Hefeweizen. So wow. I've got this one today from Germany. This is what they had. I'm not going to try to pronounce that. The beer company. Yeah. Schoferhofer, maybe something like that. But I guess you just top it up. So I don't
just
know. We're just kind of experimenting. This is off nominal here. This is what I'm doing.
Oh, nice.
Just going to put a little bit of beer in here.
It looks like you've got like some Home Depot hardware in there.
These are my metallic ice cubes. So they're a game changer. Game changer because they don't water it down. So yeah. Anyway, here
I
we go.
If it was
so
loose bottom... hardware from Home Depot that you just keep in the fridge for a while before this.
When I first saw it, I had no clue what was going on. It's like the fourth ingredient is definitely whatever those
something
are.
That makes a metallic reaction with one of the alcohols.
Just some 3D printed bolts that I got from Aerojet Rocketdyne. So
okay. They've got a lot of them these days. So
hey, this is pretty good. This is like a beer margarita.
How come
like
you only poured a little bit? Is that the rule? Like you're only supposed to just put a little bit?
I don't know, man. I'm just kind of, I don't want to water it down. I think I should put more. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I didn't read the rules. You said there's like a whole thing to it, but.
This is just a made up thing on the internet. This cool. probably isn't real.
So. Caleb, did you grab anything fun from the store or anything? Are you happy houring or are you saving it up
for dinner? I did. So I'm debating. I may wait for dinner just because I had this in the fridge and it's a really good beer, but I just don't know if I'm going to have it right now. So this is from my current favorite brewery, which is Nepenthe in Baltimore. It's called Jellyfish Huntress. And you can see a little shout out to Metroid on there. It's a 10% triple IPA.
Ooh.
It's very good.
Oh, this is going to get rowdy.
I'll have to call you an Uber.
That's why I said this is a strong maybe. Yeah, I like the art enough to just appreciate the can right now.
Damn.
It's a good looking can. I like it.
I've got... Still, Jake, it's white wine season here because it's 83 degrees today. And so I've got some Vernaccia from San Gimignano. I went to this winery when we were in Tuscany in 2018, Torchano. I didn't buy this when I was there. I bought some later because they shipped to the U.S. and it's delicious. Vernaccia. It's like that's my summer white wine of choice. So tasty. So
83 degrees, though. You got to get those numbers up. Those are rookie numbers. So
yeah, I think it might have dropped. It's 81 now. Yeah. It is just a news alert. Spotted lantern flies have arrived in Philadelphia. I have killed seven in the last two
days.
And they are tiny. You can barely see them. So I'm pretty proud of that. So Google it.
This is like the most, this is a super, super mid-Atlantic joke for
very local. Just wanted to give a shout out to all the mid-Atlantic listeners that you need to be on your best alert at the moment.
Yeah, so, what, like, what is that like applicable to, like 100 miles from like DZ, like that direction?
No, because they started in State College and have made their way out. So I think, you know, and it's in Jersey now. I think they're probably getting close to you down there in Caleb when you're back home. So keep your eyes out.
I'm just wondering if this is anything like the cicadas of last year. People are going to be equally on alert.
People here are very on alert because it's like we have to kill them. This is a mandate. So anyway. That's not what we're here to talk about.
if you bring an ear from a spotted lantern fly to the mayor of Philadelphia, he gives you one gold galleon. So you should really get on the bounty.
That's a weird way for Jim Kenney to get reelected, but it's something.
Yeah, if you bring him 10, right, you get to hug the Liberty Bell.
Yeah.
Caleb, you are fresh off of a trip to Colorado, where I've got a little screenshot here. We were just talking about how Michael Sheetz was our main source of information about you sitting on a panel of like the top news story of recent memory. So number one, how long in advance did you know about this news story that Amazon bought all of the launch vehicles? Did you know about this for a long time? Or were you like, this is an interesting panel that I'm getting asked to sit on?
I did know about this. I don't know if I'm allowed to say how early in advance.
Oh, wow. You weren't surprised when you got there.
I was not surprised. I was hearing rumors and, you know, kind of nodding my head. I think I actually first heard somebody mention like, hey, there's some big launch deal coming up about a week or two before the show. And I was like, huh, this is interesting. And then, like, you know, got the actual numbers and I was like, okay, the rumors were not even close. Like, they knew that, I mean, they knew like a third of us. Like, word was trickling out, but yeah, we had to keep a tight lip on it. And I was asked to go out and moderate that discussion and basically talk, lead a conversation between Amazon, Arianespace, Blue Origin, and United Launch Alliance on what, yes, is definitely the biggest commercial launch contract in world history.
In ever history.
I mean, it's kind of like, I feel like it's cheating to say this for space because, like, you know, the space race started like 1957. So it's like, we know, like,
biggest
very
ever.
Conclusively. Yeah.
This is very like, inspiration for milestone of you.
Like, I just got to make it. Yeah. I want to make this sound like as big a deal as possible because I was there. So no, it was really, you know, we put together a report now that my job is an analyst instead of a journalist. That was kind of the way that we sought to distill all this information. And so, like, I spent like time leading up to the conference, kind of like wrapping my arms around it. We had the press event itself. And then I spent like most of Space Symposium, like hiding near power outlets or like anywhere that I could sit down and like trying to type up everything that we thought was important and like what were the ramifications from the event on, you know, the industry at large and for Amazon in particular.
Were you at all surprised? Like, I think it was shocking when we first saw the numbers that they're buying 83 launch vehicles from all these different companies, but when you start thinking about it, you're like, yeah, of course they are. They have to, like, there's just, if I did the math previously, I would come out somewhere around this. And I think the difference in the shock maybe was that they did the Atlas V purchase last year, and then they got around to announcing a whole bunch more as one big, you know, one big dump of launch vehicle news. But it's like,
yeah, so
kind of pedestrian when you do 40 times however many satellites they need to launch.
So there's still a small element of mystery here because Amazon hasn't said the exact size of their spacecraft, and it's likely that they right. won't finalize on the size until after they've launched their two demo satellites with ABL at the end of this year. But even still, with the number of launches that they've procured and the number of spacecraft that are supposed to launch per vehicle known, you can kind of guesstimate that it's probably somewhere between 500 and 700 kilograms a satellite. And then if you also kind of continue to reverse engineer it, you can basically realize that like this looks like most, if not all, of the launch capacity that they need to launch their Gen 1 system, you know, 3,200 and some odd satellites. They definitely have the advantage of using the Atlas V from ULA as the only vehicle that has any heritage at this point to get their constellation started. And, you know, I think that's, you know, they've said publicly that it's regulatory milestones, mainly the FCC, but also the ITU, that are driving them to launch these satellites as fast as they can. So, and also usually I kind of quibble with like the terminology around racing. I feel like everybody's, you know, as soon as somebody's launching something, it's, oh, they're racing to orbit. Like things, you know, happen really fast. But it rings true a bit here because, you know, they have this FCC deadline of getting half of their constellation up by July 2026. And the rockets that they chose are all new, and it takes quite some time for rockets to scale up to have a regular launch cadence. So in this case, it is actually a race. It's a race against, you know, their own deadline, but they have to move with some urgency to get this done.
So I mean, my question is why buy them all at once? Like, why not trickle them out? Like, you know, you've had the Atlas one. Why not go now and buy, like, you know, 10 Vulcans or something, and then wait another 3 months and then buy another, like, you know, and just see how they're progressing and get like updates on them. I was really curious. I think that's like the biggest shock to me, because you're right, Anthony. Like, obviously they have to buy a, you know, freaking ton of rockets, but like they just like went up and just bought the whole constellation on like one day, which is like crazy. Like that's a headline, right? So I don't know.
To be fair, I'm not more than one day, but. They just didn't tell us about it.
Yeah, so one of the things that came out during the panel was that the negotiations for this launch contract, or these three launch contracts, took about 2 years to accomplish.
Yeah, I believe it.
It's a very long, you know, like you could get an associate's degree in the time it took for them to finalize the launch agreements here. But as to why, you know, they didn't say exactly why they chose to just do this massive bulk order. But if I was going to theorize, you know, I'd say they knew that they needed to buy up all of that capacity before anyone else could get their hands on it.
That's fair. Yeah.
You know, when we looked at the Atlas V deal, you know, initially the first thing we did was kind of scratch our heads and go, okay, why buy the last nine of, you know, a fairly expensive rocket? You know, the Atlas V has gotten a lot cheaper, you know, with Tory Bruno at the helm, but it's still not known for being particularly cheap. And then we realized, oh, they just bought up all of the only vehicle with heritage and a steady flight rate that's not retiring. Or, you know, it is retiring, but that isn't retiring like in
tomorrow.
The next, yeah, tomorrow, yeah, you know, the next 12 to, you know, 20 months. So they secured something that can like reliably get their first spacecraft up. And then after that, you know, what do you do to get this whole constellation going? You know, they can't take a back seat to anybody else. Or again, they missed their FCC deadline. And if you do that, then barring an extension, they're capped. That's as many satellites as they're allowed to launch. And that
it's a hard
is
cap,
not...
right? It's whatever they've launched. It's not that becomes your half number.
Yeah, that's it. If they only launched 1,000 satellites, then the FCC would be like, 1,000. Sorry, guys.
It's kind of a funny way to do it. At first, I thought it was like, okay, now you get to launch 2,000 total. But a hard cap is really motivating. The extension thing might explain also why they want to buy them all right now, Jake. Because if they're going to go file an extension, which, like, doing the numbers, you got 9 Atlas Vs. You're going to have like 30 other launch vehicles that you need to fly by the time that would hit, right? And I don't think on average you're going to see a Vulcan, an Ariane 6, and a New Glenn fly 10 times each with commercial customers themselves. That just doesn't seem to make sense for 2026. So has anyone filed for FCC extensions? Is the FCC open to that? Does having a whole bunch of launches already booked give them more firepower to go to the FCC and say, pandemic, war, inflation, launch contracts, stamp it, out the door, you got until 2029. Like, how does that work?
So, yeah, yes, 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 and yes. It is common to get extension requests at the FCC and also at the ITU level you basically have to go to the FCC and make a strong case for why you're trying really hard, why you deserve it, why it's in the public interest, and you know why they'll basically cause more harm than good. Because the milestones, their purpose is to make sure that people aren't hoarding spectrum, and not just sitting there trying to not make use of what in a large sense is a public good. So if you can show that you're doing that, there's a reasonable cause, reasonable estimate that you could get an extension.
Yeah, and that seems fair, right?
It is fair. And one of the things that the ITU is discussing now is actually changing or tweaking the milestones that they put in place in 2019. So the ITU, which is part of the United Nations, has regulatory milestones that in some sense are a bit more strict than the FCC, depending on how you count it. It's, you have 2 years to get 10% of your system up, 5 years to get 50%, and 7 years to get 100%. The start date on that is a little bit tricky because it depends on when you filed or when you brought your spectrum into use, things like that. But ultimately, these are big guideposts, and we can see now, it triggers what we estimated had to be at least $5 billion worth of launch contracts, and probably more. It could very easily be more.
Well, yeah, especially considering there's all those ULA investments for infrastructure, and there's, Ariane 6, I know, is supposed to be cheaper, but it's still going to be like an institutional class rocket, right? It's not the dollar store rocket by any means. So.
And they're buying the big one of all of them. They're buying they're buying the big Ariane 6.
Of everything. Yeah.
Yeah, they're buying the big one. And then after that, they're going to have to upgrade it because the solid rocket boosters, they consider it too small. So Ariane 5 is getting even bigger for this. I think that's another kind of really unique takeaway from this launch, these launch contracts, is you don't often see contracts that are so big that people like redesign their whole vehicle or a whole spaceport around it.
Yeah, you're always buying a boat. Like, all right, we'll buy an extra ship. Okay, cool. That's a very... that's just weird to me. Do you have any sense of if ULA... Like, my take... I did a Miko show this morning about this, and I want to talk about fairing size at some point with you because I feel like that's a huge storyline here. But on this investment side, ULA is building another mobile launch platform. They're buying another boat. They're building another vertical integration facility to handle more Vulcan vehicles. Do you have any sense on how, like, is that ULA covering that cost, or is that ULA saying, we'll give you better pricing and schedule priority if you also invest in us to build out more? Like, who's paying for the infrastructure here?
That's a very good question. I would imagine that ULA is paying for a portion of it, but they've also talked about expansions for all of their industrial partners. So Aerojet Rocketdyne is going to have to build more facilities. Northrop Grumman may have to build another facility. Everybody who's involved in building Vulcan to some extent, Ruag is going to have to build a whole new facility in Europe just to get all the payload dispensers out for this.
That's it's a really interesting sort of follow on because, you have to wonder, what does ULA's contract with Aerojet look like for RL-10? So they have some sort of standing thing where they can just call them up and get X amount with this much notice? Like, is it an open-ended contract, or do they have to go and negotiate with every rocket purchase like this? So do they have to go to Aerojet and be like, look, man, we're going to need like 100 of these.
116, I think it was.
Yeah. And then you get the price based on that one buy. Like, it's really interesting that the downstream effects for someone like ULA that is not vertically integrated, right? Like, it's
Northrop Grumman, they just bought 228 solid rocket boosters.
How big is that Utah facility? I don't know how big it is.
And then on the Avio side, at 72 from Europe, right? So they bought 300 solid rocket boosters in this deal. It's crazy.
This is not a scale that the space
industry. They bought more solid rocket boosters in this deal than the space shuttle ever used.
Here's a fun fact.
They're probably the second biggest user of solid rockets, like, as a customer, other than the DoD.
Yeah.
Probably at this point.
It's crazy. It's like It's hard to think about that. So yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, for someone like you, Caleb, who's really analyzing the business side of this, this must just be like just a treasure trove of joy to study and unpack and sort through. I can't imagine what your report is going to have to look like for sure.
Can you give us a prediction on how you think this is going to go? Like, what is the timeline involved here? They said it was a 5-year term for all these launches. Do you think it's going to go for 5 years? Do you think they're going to get an extension? What is the Caleb Henry fan fiction on how Kuiper gets rolled out?
So I'll tell you what I think is the biggest hurdle here. And we've already alluded to it in some aspects, but new rockets take a long time to get up to like a steady operational cadence. And all three of these vehicles that are supposed to be used are at least 2 years behind schedule. So not only are they kind of experiencing and hopefully at the tail end of their own launch delays, but once they've finished that, they're going to have to go and start launching 2, 3, 5, 10 times a year. And we ran the numbers, you know, we looked at several vehicles for their first 5 years. And on average, a new vehicle, the average flight rate for a new rocket is just under 3 launches a year for its first 5 years. That's not very fine. We're including Falcon 9 in that. That includes Atlas 5. That includes Ariane 5. Like, it's not something that the industry is good at. Scale is hard. And I'm wondering, because these companies have this advance notice that, okay, you've got a massive order, will they be able to handle it? And it's not clear. You know, Arianespace was preparing for a significantly lighter demand than they had projected when they started that program in 2014. You know, they were forecasting 11 to 12 launches a year. Then as the geo market declined and Starlink and all these things kind of changed the shape of the industry, they were starting to look at single digit Ariane launches a year and getting nervous about whether or not their industrial base would be healthy or not. Now that tune has completely changed. You know, this is a whole market that went from like, they weren't starving, but they weren't really looking at this like robust growth market. So yeah, they had prepared to shrink, and now they have to go into overdrive.
So I don't follow Ariane very well. Maybe Anthony, you might know this too, but so we're hearing all this chatter now of like Europe wanting to take their own people to space. Do these upgraded solids help in any way with that? Like, does that give them the right, you know, can they funnel that investment forward into, you know, a space capsule that Europe can put people up with? I'm curious. I don't know.
I don't know the bump that they get from the better solids to Leo. I mean, I think they're already fine because even the Ariane 62, right? 2 solid rocket boosters does 10 tons to low Earth orbit. And
okay.
All that's right. So it's already like, if you're in the
you're already, you know, past Soyuz size there, I think. Right.
So, well, yeah, you're a couple thousand above that. And Ariane 64 does double that. So they're already in the ballpark.
The upgrade's supposed to add 2 metric tons to the vehicle.
And that's the one that's also used on Vega C, right? That's the important part. They're trying to have like that common solid rocket booster that they use at the first stage on Vega C. I might be bullshitting, Caleb. You can tell me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's what the case is.
That's what they are supposed to do. I have not yet heard ESA or Avio comment on what this does to Vega C performance. It's also interesting because the Vega C upper stage, you know, as people now are well familiarized with, comes from Ukraine. And there's an open question as to whether or not they're going to have to replace the upper stage with something new. So if the upper stage changes and the first stage changes, you know, like Vega C is a 4-stage rocket, but so that's a lot of change for this vehicle. So I would really like to know, hopefully get answers at some point, what happens to Vega C in the midst of all of these forces that are completely outside of their control that are changing that rocket.
Yeah.
Do you think that you mentioned how like the slow flight rate ramp up of rockets tend to go? Not that Vulcan, Centaur, and Ariane 6 are heritage units, right? But they are upgrading so many parts of the rocket, but the rocket like concept of operations is the same from Atlas 5 to Ariane 6, right? Like, or Atlas V, Ariane 5, to Vulcan Centaur and Ariane 6, are they operate the same way? So is there any benefit to not having to figure out like new, because I didn't do all the math, but I'm pretty sure like even the first stages probably stage at the same velocity or similar enough that it kind of shakes out in the wash. Do you think there's any benefit there that they're just upgrading like the same idea versus New Glenn, which is like, we're going to go, we have four first stages and we hope that one of them lands on the boat so we can fly our second and third launch. Like how does that shake out?
I really hope that these companies, the ones that have experience, are able to leverage it. But honestly, looking at, you know, when we did that comparison, you know, Ariane 5 was not Europe's first Ariane vehicle. You know, that was an evolution from Ariane 4, and it still had a very slow, early flight rate. I think it flew once a year for the first 4 years, actually. Ariane 5 is kind of a special case because it did not have a good start. There were several failures in the early days of the Ariane 5.
And it was pretty different from Ariane 4 too. Like 4 was pretty well connected to 3. Like that 1 to 4, this like Frankenstein rocket that just kept globbing parts
on you. The start of your Kerbal career. Where you're like, I unlocked a new part. Put it on there.
At some point, they're just like, I guess we've gone to 3 now. Okay, I think we're at 4 now. I don't know. But like Ariane 5 was like its own like pretty distinct unit, right? Like I don't know if there's... Yeah, I don't know. And with the solids, that probably made it very, very different in terms of your con ops, right?
Yeah. I mean, when Ariane 6 was being described to me kind of in the early years of its development, the folks at Ariane Group described it as a quote, industrialization of Ariane 5, which was their way of saying, this isn't something that's crazy new. We are taking this rocket and we're going to build it in a way that's more competitive. But it's still taking just as long to make the Ariane 6 as it is, you know, a brand new rocket, basically.
New launch pad, new facilities. Yeah, it's so much new that...
Yeah, so it's been a pretty intense evolution. And I do think it's an open question. Will it scale quickly because they have this experience, you know, over 100 Ariane 5 launches and, you know, skill at doing this and organizing payloads and stuff? Or is it going to be a steeper learning curve than even they envisioned at the onset?
Yeah. There's also the question, I mean, people don't talk about people enough with this stuff too, right? So look at someone like ULA, if they want to go from 4 rockets a year that they're doing right now to 20 rockets a year, they're going to have to hire, and those people are all going to be brand new, and they're not going to have the institutional memory of being like, oh, this is just like an Atlas, no big deal. We just change the label on the side of the rocket and it's all the same, right? So, I mean, so I don't know how much, for Blue, it's all new people. So that's the problem they have as well. And then for Ariane, like how much does this increase their flight rate? Is this, cause they only bought, sorry, I already forget the numbers, but is it like going from 18, like 1 or 2 year? Okay. So, you know, I think it's probably not as dramatic of an increase in annual flight rate for Ariane as it is for ULA and Blue, right?
Yeah. So it was like, I think in the past they were targeting, they mentioned the early goal was 11. Then they started targeting single digits. Now with Kuiper, the range that I heard was 10 to 15. I would imagine it's the upper part of that range.
And why did they, the New Glenn thing is confusing me because it's like, we bought 12 with an option 15. Why did they buy an option?
Just to make sure it works.
Yeah. What are they hedging there?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good question, and I'm guessing here as well, but I would think that it's the vehicle that, you know, is, all these vehicles are new, but Blue has the add-on of being a completely new launch company.
New.
It's new. So they probably want to prove it out first.
Yeah, and the flight rate on New Glenn was never really predicted to be that high, especially initially. So if they've bought 12 and they're not really launching for another 2 years at best, I'm going to guess they're throwing a bunch of Kuiper satellites on the demo mission of New Glenn because you're making a couple thousand of them. So if you lose it, you lose it. Not, but right? If it works out, you got 60 more on orbit, so that's cool. So I guess maybe those last 15, it's like, if you do really well and you're flying on schedule and you still fit within our FCC window, we'll buy a bunch more. But we don't believe that you are going to fit in our FCC window. It's kind of what that's what it reads to me, you know. And that's everyone wants to say the whole like they had to buy Blue Origin launch vehicles and because it's Amazon and Jeff Bezos, which is not true because it's different people and there's a big firewall and Amazon is ruthless. So if it wasn't going to work out for them, it wasn't going to work out.
Yeah,
you know, but it is kind of like a little bit embarrassing that that's the one that clearly is being hedged against.
I think it also has to do with like how many launches does Kuiper actually need? I mean, they haven't said, and trying to run the numbers, like I mentioned, there's sort of a delta between like what their final mass is going to be. And, you know, if the satellites are all 700 kilograms or more, you know, they'll probably need more launches than if they're 500. You know, what we do know is that they've described the Kuiper satellites as being bigger than their peer mega constellations. So, you know, OneWeb at 150 kilograms, SpaceX at somewhere around 300 kilograms. And we know that the Kuiper satellites are going to be high power. They've emphasized that these are going to be high power spacecraft. And if you have a lot of power, that means you need bigger batteries, bigger solar arrays, you know, everything increases in size. So I would imagine that the options could be a hedge, not just for seeing how Blue Origin performs, but determining if they need to throttle up or down Kuiper's own launch demand based on the final design of their spacecraft.
Right, right.
Volume seems like a huge part of it too, because even the initial, were those numbers of how many per launch, did they come out of your panel with them? Like the 61 on New Glenn and all that? Even if you look at that, like fitting 61 under a New Glenn fairing compared to fitting 60 Starlinks under the tiny Falcon 9 fairing. Right, that is a good indication of volume. Yeah, they definitely don't fit as nicely, which is why I think, you know, my thesis on Miko earlier was that the comparison was not Falcon 9. The comparison was Falcon Heavy with the extended fairing, because they clearly need long fairings on Atlas V, on Vulcan Centaur, and Ariane 6, and New Glenn. They're giant fairings. SpaceX's are tiny. They're building a bigger one, but it's like, I don't know if anyone knows when that's going to land. Is it in 4 years? Like, we don't really know which... Do we know which of the NRO payloads need that? I don't know. This sounds like an Anthony department thing, so if you two don't know, we're probably screwed here.
Yeah, we're asking you. What's going on here?
But anyway, like the point being, volume, I think they're going to be volume limited before they're mass limited on all of these vehicles, you know?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Big fairings.
So,
gotta have them.
So... What does Blue do with BE-4 right now? Because this is like 10x pressure in an already high pressure situation for them, right? Because like we were already having discussions about like, you know, New Glenn's in trouble because every last BE-4 they're going to squeeze out is going to go right to ULA for DoD stuff. Like there was already like every spare capacity they had was going to get sucked into a Vulcan rocket. Now they have to do that again, twice as many, and supply 10 times as many rockets as they were going to make. Like, so does this, is money going to help them solve that? You know, just the extra launch contract of like, okay, now we can scale up, or is there something different they have to do? I'm just going to throw that question out there. I don't know. Cause it seems like a tough spot for like whoever's in charge of BE-4 is like gotta be sweating now if they weren't already.
Yeah. I asked Tori at the satellite show in March whether or not it was too late to switch to the AR-1. And
it was like, yeah, yes, Caleb. He, Jesus yeah, Christ, go on Twitter once in your life.
I wanted to know. You know, they when the two rocket engines were announced, you know, AR-1 seemed like it wasn't asked for, and they built it anyway, and you know. It was the odd one out, and you know, now BE-4 is 5 years late. Certainly would have you asking the question, could I have had an engine, you know, a few years sooner than I do now? You're right, Tori's answer was no. But he has been more positive about the BE-4 lately compared to past events. So it's still hard to read into that because, you know, they've been saying soon. It's been soon for years now.
Yeah,
it's obvious tomorrow, but I do think that their tune has genuinely changed, and I have to imagine for Kuiper that they would not have taken the risk here if they also didn't trust that the BE-4 is actually close to the point where it could be ready for launch. I mean, it's obvious why they didn't choose, why Kuiper didn't choose SpaceX, because Musk and Bezos have been feuding forever.
I'm unconvinced if Bezos rolled up and was like, hey Elon, do you want $8 billion, that he would be like, nah, I'm okay.
Bezos is never gonna do that.
Yeah, I guess maybe that's more likely, but he's not even at Amazon anymore. He bounced. He's still sailing on his yacht.
That SpaceX SpaceX would take their money, but Blue wouldn't give it. Amazon wouldn't give it. No, I mean, you look at the vehicles that are out there. It was these three that they chose. Falcon 9, which you can rule out. Russian vehicles are ruled out. Chinese vehicles are always ruled out. And
Antares, don't go on Antares for me. Come on.
We know Antares.
Antares can launch four.
Yeah, it's launched barely more than like Rocket Lab. Well, that's the other one that people were talking about, was Neutron. That's you know, projected in the time range that this would be helpful for. So, but to your point, like maybe they do need to buy a couple more later, and if Neutron does well, they could be in a good spot to launch, you know, a couple spares or half a plane or whatever it is. Because
they're gonna need excess capacity beyond the FCC mandate. Yeah, right? Yeah. Like they're gonna need to do replacements and then their Gen 2 and
orbital
stuff.
So spares, they can updates.
Like if you know, 3 years from now they're like up against it, or 2 years from now, or whatever, they could theoretically go in, buy a bunch of Neutrons, and then, you know, push the whatever rocket is late, they can push that to the later ones. They just keep that contract for, you know, that's always a flexible thing they can do, right?
Yeah.
We could make a launch company if you guys want.
Let's do it.
Yeah. We have a business case now.
Yeah, not
we
enough
think
of them.
We can get Amazon sloppy seconds. Give us some money.
All right, here's our theory. It's Antares, but a giant fairing. Antares heavy. It's five Antares.
I want somebody to Photoshop
with the AR-1 on the bottom. You mentioned AR-1. That's the only hope for AR-1 is that Antares comes calling, right? Like that's the way out for AR-1 if they still want it to exist.
Firefly was talking about it some time ago.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So, and Firefly's beta, if they ever do it, would be around the same class as the Neutron vehicle. So both of those are slated for. They're advertised for 2024. I just tack on a customary 2 year delay to everything that I see announced. So 2026 is in the range. The most realistic for both of those in my head. Those would be, I think, viable constellation vehicles. You know, they're kind of in that medium class where Soyuz once occupied, and we saw that did work for OneWeb up until it didn't. So
people are asking about India in the chat. Michael asked, surprised India didn't get any. I'll throw in Japan in there as well. They've got the H3 coming online soon. Is there any thoughts you have on like India and Japan and how they maybe can maneuver in? I mean, India obviously has done a lot of rideshare missions over the last couple of years for U.S. companies and whatnot, but there is that hole opening up with Russian vehicles being no longer useful to anyone.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that India didn't get any launch contracts here, because Amazon was prioritizing heavy lift vehicles, you know, like the heaviest of the heavy. You know, they forced Ariane to make a bigger version of their rocket that they're almost done building just so that they could do this mission or do these contracts. India's largest vehicle, you know, the GSLV, is still suffering from issues with its cryogenic upper stage. You know, I think four flights have failed. Off the top of my head, I think it's, I won't even do that. I don't know what the failure rate is for GSLV, but it has not proven itself to be a reliable vehicle yet. It flies very infrequently and it often has issues. PSLV is too small. Japan's MHI, I was actually a bit surprised that they didn't get anything, because if you wanted to have dissimilar redundancy, you would choose only one rocket with the BE-4 engine. But, you know, I don't know what the negotiations were here. You know, they chose three companies that they think could get it done. I will say that MHI has slowly started to prove that it can do commercial missions. I think they were almost entirely focused on the government market in Japan. They were known in the past for being expensive, and hopefully they can bring their cost down with H3, but it just hasn't been proven yet. Maybe Amazon wanted to see more evidence of that. You know, they have the Inmarsat contract, they had the Emirati Mars mission, those are definitely some flagships that could usher in more commercial business for Japan, but it's still in a wait and see. And I guess maybe one last thought on that, because so much launch capacity has been taken up by Kuiper, you know, in our report, we have this could benefit Mitsubishi Heavy Industries and others, yeah. Right? Like literally there's nowhere else that you can go to SpaceX, or you can go to Japan. There's not a lot of launch capacity. So they could win in that way.
Right. Because like whether you want a contract or not, this is still demand, right? It's still just huge launch demand. So, yeah.
And before this, it was like no launch company would have said like, we're happy with our amount of customers that we have, you know, like talk to anyone, go to a conference, stay at the bar late, talk to anyone that works at a launch company, see how confident they are and how many launches they have on their manifest. No one was confident about it. Yeah, no one.
Yeah.
No one from the company that you're thinking of that was comfortable. No one was comfortable. So yeah, you're right that like this definitely was a lot of demand. Now it has eaten up a lot of supply. So I don't know. People come calling. Spaceflight's got to find somebody to fly with. They're SOL on the maybe the heavy lift. So maybe they'll go do some more in India, do some in Japan.
There's
Wait, didn't
be
they get
some
bought
huge,
by a Japanese company?
Yeah, I think Mitsui did have honestly, the details of that M&A deal were always kind of cloudy to me. So I know that they had, I'd have to read up on it again.
Yeah,
because Spaceflight did so many things and they only wanted parts of it. So I don't know.
This is also February 2020, so things probably changed since that date. Some weird stuff since then.
Everyone's February 2020 plans are very different now.
Totally different.
One thing that we didn't talk about, and it's probably worth touching on at least briefly, a surprise for me and I think everybody at the Kuiper announcement was that even though they had a panel lined up with these three major launch companies, when Amazon got to talking about the system, the first thing that they did was talk about their antenna. And, you know, Anthony, you and I have talked about this in past Miko episodes.
Yeah, for years.
The nitty gritty of antennas.
I think you blew my mind once when you told me that like the phased array that were on the market was like 40 grand was, you know, that's a cheap one, 40 grand.
Yeah, that's what everyone was excited about.
So. Great.
Gives you a sense of price in that world. I mean, when your only other applications are like detecting missiles on Navy ships or like being embedded in radio telescopes, like yeah.
Turns out you can charge a lot for that. That seems like a very value priced activity.
Exactly.
So what do you think of that? That they're saying what, 500 or something was their statement?
Yeah. Yeah. And they said that they didn't even start with the satellite program until after they had figured out the antenna. So that's really important because it's a complete reversal of how basically every other mega constellation has been done. Everyone said they figure out the antenna in time, you know, whether it was Teledesic or O3b or OneWeb or Starlink. It was always the second step or the third step, or the next step. And it just frankly didn't happen. Or it happened in a way that was so underwhelming that these constellations did not live up to their original vision. You know, for Starlink and Kuiper, it's still playing out. But
yeah,
if it's true,
January 2019, to this tweet from Greg
Weiler
that it was what $200 or something. That's the old Caleb article here from your past life. What the hell happened to this whole storyline that Greg Weiler was like, we got it, we nailed it, $200. Peace.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, I as well have learned and matured from that experience of writing about this article. I tell people now that if you see one of those boards, like those printed boards of an antenna, that's the equivalent of the engine hot fire for the antenna industry. Like, it's sexy,
but like,
it looks
cuts
cool.
off after 2 seconds, right?
It doesn't actually mean as much as you think it does.
So are you interpreting that statement from Amazon then as like they're going to come in with and do the Amazon thing and just gut the price of this service as like a really competitive offering just because they have this antenna figured out? Like, what's
Amazon
your
basics antenna?
Yeah, exactly. Like they're just like, they just find out what everyone else is paying and then the algorithm just knocks 10% off that price and they win every time.
You know, they didn't go into the engineering details of how they plan on bringing the price down. What they emphasized was volume, which is something the industry has frequently talked about. But usually when people talk about it, it's always startups. It's, hey, we've raised, you know, a few tens of millions of dollars. And as soon as we have scale, yeah, it's not Amazon. Amazon is already shipping millions of things. If they say that they're going to ship millions of antennas, it's much more believable. And then the second element of this is, because the spacecraft are going to be high power, you know, there's a ratio here. You can either have a high power spacecraft and a smaller antenna, or you can have a smaller spacecraft and a really big antenna. And so it looks to me like they've decided to really emphasize the spacecraft part and say, hey, we're going to put all the muscle into what we have on orbit, drive down the cost of the antenna, and let consumers buy that part. So hopefully,
sounds right to me.
Sounds legit.
Yeah.
That's good insight right there. That's a good note.
I'm like a potential customer of these constellations because like I live in a place with not good infrastructure and I want to move even outside of town. So I have SpaceX available to me now, but I would love for someone to put a little pressure on them for price because their price is not great right now. So.
Yeah. And that's the good thing about having more than one constellation. You know, people, the whole idea, and you know, I think US internet subscriptions suck a lot of the time because people have just one option, maybe two at best. And if we could get multiple systems up there and have them drive each other to be better, it's the consumer in the end that wins.
It's local anecdote. I can see, if I look out this window, I can see the Comcast tower and just
almighty,
so you know,
Comcast.
I live in Cable Town, right? And I'm on a street that is served by Verizon Fios, and it is shocking how cheap I can get Comcast service compared to my friends that live on streets that don't have Verizon to their house. Now I have Verizon. I have this nice gigabit fiber, but
street pricing, right?
It's double or triple at like friends that live in Northern Liberties in Philly that don't have a lot of Fios roll out there, double or triple for the same Comcast plan. I'm like, all right. So if Jake's in this situation with Starlink, then yeah, there needs to be somebody else ready to sell. And you know, I don't know, maybe we can do like 5 minutes on OneWeb, because how do you think their timeline is altered now that they have to find, I mean, they got all these, like, I don't know if we know how many Falcon 9s they bought, but they bought some Falcon 9s. What do you think their timeline shifts, right? Because they were going to say August was when they were going to finish their rollout, and they said, man, we'll be able to serve the whole world then, but is it still a year away or more than that?
Yeah, August was the original goal. When their whole launch agreement fell apart, we were estimating a minimum 12-month delay between then and when they would finish their constellation. With SpaceX, it's still hard to speculate because they issued the most cryptic press release, you know, the history of press releases. It was just, we have an agreement. No, we're not telling you when it starts. No, we're not telling you how many. Please go home. And like, that was it. So... you know, I just guessing if they could get at least, you know, I don't know. it's really hard to guess. I think it's reasonable to think that they could get the rest of their constellation up, you know, within 12 to 18 months. It really depends on what the parameters are for their SpaceX agreement. I think it was an interesting detail that came out that Arianespace basically had to go and call up SpaceX and say, hey, like, it's your turn. You know, just some of the good in the industry. You know, there's a lot of his competition. There's only a few players. Everybody wants to be the best, but it's good that people work together when they need to get these things done. So
it's the meme, though, the handshake meme. It's like, you're up, Elon Musk, you're shitting on Russian launch industry. It's like, that's the meme, you know? Like, both of them were like, let's show them we don't need them.
There you go.
Yeah.
You know, one of our early, you know, it's something that we were speculating internally when this first happened and before they had signed the SpaceX agreement was that maybe maybe OneWeb could use this kind of agreement or use what happened to them as an excuse to jump directly to a second gen constellation, because they've been pretty open in talking about how the constellation that they were designing, you know, 2015 thought was going to be revolutionary is not revolutionary in 2022. Mm-hmm. You know, it was designed with 1.1 terabits of capacity. It sounded like a huge amount, but Viasat is putting up basically the same amount on a single GEO satellite, which they'll hopefully launch this year. I haven't looked at their schedule lately, but you know, if a single satellite can do what their entire LEO constellation is supposed to do, that changes the script. And then, you know, everybody else, you know, SpaceX talks about launching a terabit per Falcon 9. Telesat Lightspeed was supposed to be 10 to 15 terabits. Like, it, all of a sudden they go from being, you know, this fancy, you know, the greatest thing ever to like, you know, like the Ford Taurus of the, of the satellite sector. Like, just
we got our episode
snuck
title.
The title in right at the 53rd minute. Amazing.
They know that they have to do. They know they have to do something new. I drove a Ford Tafari. Excuse me, Ford Taurus.
Disclaimer.
It was my first car, so very familiar with what it can and can't do. But yeah, we were talking about that. You know, maybe this could be their opportunity. They want bigger, more powerful satellites. They are much more amenable to inter-satellite links. You know, they've got all these shareholders that have interest, you know, putting, you know, GPS, PNT type payloads on it, and they want to have configurable capacity and all sorts of stuff. Could be their excuse to just jump to the upgrade, but that looks much, much less likely if they have launch agreements in place that can get those last 200 satellites up and on orbit.
Right.
It's good all times. Right.
The constellation wars have begun.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus Christ. It's not the title.
I don't want it to be. The Ford Taurus one's too good.
Caleb, we had you on like right when you were leaving Space News or right after you left. I forget exactly what the timing was there, but how long have you been not doing the journalism thing, doing the analytics thing? And what is your review this many years in?
Yeah. Do you like it?
Yeah, so it's been a year and a half now, and it's still a bit surreal. You know, like, I think because of switching jobs during COVID, it's very strange. Like, I emerged at this conference, and people are still like, I love your writing. I'm like, my last byline is like published like well over, you know, a year ago.
You're like, you're not paying me money at Quilty Analytics. You're not reading my writing.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, what's the last thing you read, huh? But It's been good. So I appreciate like having time to kind of do more deep thought on big announcements like this one, you know, kind of think across the implications for the industry. I think I brought this up when I was here before, that I always struggled with trying to like have an opinion on things, because people would ask me my opinion, and like as a journalist, you just kind of like, it's like beat out of you to have, like, you don't have opinions, you know. I think the only thing I had an opinion on in the space industry was SLS, and it's because I never wrote about it. But now
everybody
now
has an
opinion
about SLS. Something. It comes with the territory. Yeah.
We even got that out of Faust when he was on the show in December.
It's hard to not have an opinion on that. But you know, I think there's been some kind of professional growth there, and just learning how to work as an analyst and how to try and provide insights to people and not just keep referring them to, you know, statements or articles or whatever. So that's been good. You know, I enjoy it, and I'm still in this industry. I don't think I'll ever leave. I hope I never leave it. So it's fun. And I also enjoy still being a neutral voice, getting the survey, getting to literally still talk about everything that I did before, whether it's rockets or antennas or the FCC, the ITU, or satellite manufacturing, you know, yeah. These are all the things. And so it's been good. I hear more things under, you know, NDAs and
I was going to ask if you get more info as a journalist or not as a journalist.
It's weird because I sometimes think I knew more as a journalist, just because you're just like vacuuming up information all the time and then like publishing it. But then at the same time, I like, you know, just things that you hear all the time. They're like, oh, okay, well, I can't say that, but that's pretty cool. People would like to know that. So it's fun. You know, if anything, I think it's been encouraging just to like see all of the exciting things that the industry is doing and, you know, kind of to see a different side of it. You know, people as they're in the process of figuring out what they're going to do next, so that when they do go to the press, they kind of go with a conviction that they've made the right choice. You know, sometimes as an analyst, you can see how the sausage is made, whereas before, you know, they just kind of presented you what they've made and that was it.
You had an interesting timing too, where like, you know, the last couple of years of your writing were the changeover moment from like the geosat industry to mega constellations. And now you switched right at the moment when that started getting real and there was actually hardware going to orbit and launch contracts being announced. So I feel like that timing really worked out. Probably not coincidental to your decision to switch over. But it's, I don't know. I've just, as somebody who like, you know, Jake and I stay away from the word journalist for what we do, but I'm more comfortable with the word analyst. And so I'm like, okay, that's interesting that Caleb's doing that thing now. So I've been like keeping an eye on how you feel about it generally.
I will say that.
Lowercase A, yes. Yeah,
okay. People, even though I made that transition during a time when it seemed like the industry was in like a deep like session of soul searching, you know, the whole decline in geostationary satellite orders was because nobody knew what to do next. You know, the tried and true model for decades appeared to be failing. And even with hardware going up, there are still more people asking questions like than ever. You know, I think every analyst firm is very busy right now. People coming to them, coming to us, trying to understand what direction, you know, every facet of the industry is going in, because it's all changing. And some people are pushing forward with plans that they have convictions will work out. But a lot of people are still trying to understand what is the future of this industry going to look like in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. And, you know, there's more excitement, I think, still than there has been in the past. I mean, even though this is outside of my domain, just being on the Space Symposium floor and seeing like a Toyota branded rover, you know, prototype, whatever, for the moon, I was like, well, that's really cool. You don't see them here usually.
So wait, for the Ford Taurus rover, though. It. Come on.
I'm waiting for my Ford Taurus moon rover. That's what I want.
That's the one you get after the prototypes. Once we hit scale and everyone needs a rover, then look at the Ford Taurus rover.
Incredible.
But it's good. Things are good.
The Ford Taurus Litro.
Shit, that's so good. God, that is such a deep reference.
Yeah, yeah. Deep cut. It's a deep cut.
That Venn diagram is where Off Nominal lives. I love that.
The Ford Taurus Litro. Yeah.
Oh, all right. Caleb, where Anthony, should people... I was going to let Caleb do his plugs first, because we just talked about this shit, but we didn't tell anyone. Where do they go? If people were like Caleb Henry fans and they're dying for more Caleb Henry in their
life... How do they buy your reports?
Yeah, how do they pay you money?
Yeah, you can go to our website, quiltyanalytics.com. All our research is there. Most of it is behind a paywall, although every once in a while we do issue something for free. I think there's a free Earth observation geospatial report up there now. You can also follow me on Twitter. It's chenry_QA or chenry_QA.
Chenry.
And
nice.
I'm there mostly retweeting stuff, but occasionally I opine. So that's good stuff.
Do it, people.
Excellent.
Got some links in the show notes.
Okay. Yeah. Anthony, what have you been up to? I know you got an episode out today on this very topic, nonetheless.
I did put one out. So if you want more thoughts on fairings and money, and I think that's probably all we missed. We got through most of it. So you probably got most of my takes in this.
And why isn't Starship part of this?
The Starship thing. Oh, and the small launch industry. We didn't talk about that at all here, but like, boy howdy, are they missing out. So... if you want some thoughts on that, I've got it over at Manage and Cutoff. Did you put out a show since we talked?
No. So I'm a little behind.
I read your interview announcement today, which is what it is.
Yes. come. That's for patrons. So if you'd like to sign up for the We Martians Patreon, you'll get early advance notice of all the great interviews coming up. But I will just tease that Decadal Survey for Planetary Science is dropping, which will be the biggest policy news I have. Well, it only comes out once a decade, so it's the biggest one I've covered so far. So I'm pretty excited for that. It's coming up.
It's the most important decadal survey in your life.
It is.
It's like elections. Every time one comes up, it's the most important
it's
one
the
of
most
your life.
Important.
Lifetime.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, next
big
week,
report though. Big report.
What are we doing here next week, Jake?
Next week, so we're being a little loosey-goosey, a little open with everything next week. So we have some, we're going to leave a slot open here to talk about some of the news coming out, because there's more wet dress rehearsal stuff happening. There is potentially some other stuff dropping as well. And so we might just do like a grab bag. We're gonna do it off nom style and see what comes up. So we may have a guest for that. So stay tuned. Just keep an eye on the Twitter feed and on the channel. Of course, if you subscribe, you get notices of all that stuff. And if you really like the show and you want to give us more money to buy fancy German beers imported to Mexico, you can become a member
wine.
As well. You can become a member.
Dinner for
Caleb. And so there's a join button down there if you're on desktop. If you're on like mobile, I think it's like a top menu bar up here.
Scroll
until you see membership, and then you can pop up. So $5 a month joins you the channel, and he gets you into the Discord to hang out with the rest of us, all doing shenanigans in there every day.
But pay us money so we can buy a Ford Taurus.
Yeah, we need
That's
to buy a Ford
for.
Taurus.
That's the real reason.
Caleb, thanks for hanging out with us, and I'll see you in some couple minutes.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
See you, everybody.
See you.
Thanks, Caleb.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. End of test.